Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents The Blackfoot Trail by Charles G. West, narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by David Harris, Michael Glenn, Kimberly Gilbert, Bradley Smith, Terrence Aselford, Eric Mesner, Evan Casey, Mort Shelby, Joe Brack, Thomas Keegan, Colleen Delaney, Lily Beacon, Tim Getman, James Lewis, Patrick Bussing, Sherry Bird, Tim Pabone, Christopher Graybill, Christopher Sheeran, Scott McCormick, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Ren Casey, Nanette Savard, and Richard Rowan.
Joe Fox?
The rocky cliff stood like a castle wall before the two nearly exhausted men.
Joe Fox!
Malcolm Lindstrom looked around him nervously. It had been a long, hard climb up to the base of the cliff through thick forests of fir and pine.
I don't know about this. It gives me a worrisome feeling.
Pete Watson turned away from the wall and peered down the narrow game trail they had followed to this point, half expecting to see a Blackfoot war party emerge from the forest behind them.
Smack dab in the heart of Blackfoot country, just the two of us, looking for a man that some say don't even exist. How do we know this Joe Fox feller ain't just a legend the Indians dreamed up? Hell, that feller down by the river sent us up here, and he probably ain't ever really seen him. Just said the engine said this is where they've seen him. I hate to say this, but that feller might have just been setting us up to get jumped by some of his Blackfoot friends. I never trusted a Frenchman anyway.
You worry too much.
Although Malcolm was entertaining some of the same thoughts expressed by his brother-in-law, the fact of the matter was they were where they were. It was too late to consider whether the Frenchman at the trading post on the river below was a scoundrel bent on sending a party of warriors to ambush him or not. As far as the real or imagined existence of the man the Blackfoot called Joe Fox, Father Paul claimed to have known him as a boy before the legend was created. And it was the priest's conviction that Joe Fox, if he could be found, was the best bet to find Malcolm's brother and the rest of the party that set out to follow a northern route to Oregon. Malcolm was not a man to take unnecessary risks, and he had advised his brother against joining a party of seven families determined to join an earlier group that had made the journey by wagon the year before. Because of a late start and the fact that there had been reports of Sioux war parties along the South Pass route, they had decided to cross farther north through the mountains, hoping to strike the Mullen Road. Reports they had heard told of poor conditions on the road, so they decided their chances were better if they traveled by mule train instead of trying to cross with wagons. They were led by a man named Skinner, who claimed to know a route to the Mullen Road that was safe and short. He claimed that he would have them safely in the Willamette Valley before August. It was now late September, and already some snow had fallen in the mountains, with no sign of the pilgrims. His brother Bradley had promised to telegraph him as soon as they had safely reached Fort Walla Walla, and there had been no word. Malcolm feared the worst. Everyone he had talked to who had any knowledge of the Rocky Mountains had told him the undertaking was a fool's mission this late in the season. But he was determined to do all he could to find the missing party. Accompanied by his brother-in-law, He had followed the route of the mule train as far as Helena, where the trail disappeared. Asking around several businesses in Helena, they came upon some store owners who remembered the mule train and told them it had moved on toward the west. Malcolm and Pete had met with no luck in picking up their trail, however. Coming upon a mission run by a Jesuit priest named Father Paul, he and Pete had sought help there. Father Paul had advised them to search for Joe Fox, stating his belief that Fox was their best chance of finding the party of settlers.
Oh, no one knows the mountains better than Joe Fox, and he can travel through the Blackfoot country without fear of harm by the Indians.
Begging your pardon, Father, how in the world would we ever find Joe Fox? If nobody but Injuns has ever seen him, what chance have we got? We could wander around in those mountains for 50 years and never lay eyes on him, especially if what they say about him not wanting to be found is true.
That's probably pretty much the truth, but the only reason I'm suggesting it is because one of my congregation, Sam Black Crow, told me just yesterday that he was sure he had sighted Joe Fox on the east slope of Blackjack Mountain, up near the cliff. I'm told that he often camps in these parts this time of year. You may think it's too dangerous to seek him out, but I think it's your only chance of finding your brother and the others.
So now they stood staring at a blank stone wall, with no idea where to go from this point.
You know, your sister's gonna be mad as hell at you if anything happens to me.
Hell, she'd most likely hug my neck.
Joe! Fox!
What do you want?
Like a ghost, the tall figure seemed to have materialized from nowhere to stand before him, dressed in animal skins and holding a rifle ready to fire. Struck dumb and stunned, Pete, without thinking, started to lift his rifle from the ground.
Don't do that.
I wasn't gonna.
Why do you call my name?
Are you Joe Fox?
That's right.
We were hoping you would help us find a party of white families that must have got lost somewhere in these mountains on their way west.
Who told you to come to me?
Father Paul, at the mission.
Studying him carefully, Malcolm was not certain whether Joe Fox was Indian or white. It was hard to tell, dressed as he was, in skins and clean-shaven and wearing his dark hair in two long braids. He was tall, taller than either Malcolm or Pete. The Blackfeet were tall people, but Joe Fox was taller still. Under his soft cowskin shirt, he wore an unadorned breech cloth and leggings that reached to his thighs. A belt held a knife sheath and a small pouch. In addition to an early model Winchester, he had a bow strapped to his back and a weasel skin quiver of arrows. Malcolm had never seen a more fitting image of a Blackfoot warrior, and yet this magnificent specimen of raw power was possessed of fine, chiseled facial features more suggestive of a white man. Malcolm decided that Joe Fox was a half-breed.
Why would Father Paul send you to me?
Like I said, we're looking for some folks that might have got lost in these mountains. The army wouldn't help us. Said they didn't have the troops to spare. Father Paul sent us to find you. Said there wasn't nobody that knowed the mountains like you.
Joe shifted his gaze from one of his visitors to the other, sizing him up. He could read nothing that held a hint of larceny in the face of either man.
Those folks you're looking for must have been crazy to try to cross all the mountain ranges between here and Oregon country. You're lucky you two got up this far with your scalps still on. Many of my people have gone to the reservation, but many have not, and still live as Napi meant, the Siksika to live. The Blackfeet don't like the white men, and it's dangerous for two white men to pass through this country. I saw your horses below by the stream. I thought about stealing them, but I was curious to see what fools would leave their horses alone by a stream where two game trails crossed.
The folks we're looking for are good Christian people. My brother and his wife are with them. They ain't out to bother the Blackfoot or any other tribe. They're just wanting to pass through on their way to Oregon.
I know the party you speak of. I watched them as they tried to cross this mountain range. I counted 36 mules, all packed heavy.
That's right. There was 8 families, and each of them took 4 mules.
Mighty tempting to a Blackfoot war party. They tried to come in following the river, but they had to turn around when they got to the falls. They tried 2 more times before giving up and moving on.
Where'd they go then?
I don't know. I was just glad they left. All I can tell you is they pushed on north of here looking for another place to try, I suppose.
Can you find them?
I might if I was looking for them, if they're still alive.
We don't expect you to do it for nothing. We can't pay you. How much would it take to get you to track them?
I never said for sure I could find them, but I'll see what I can do. For my part, I'll ask for extra cartridges for my rifle and some supplies. Sugar, salt, and coffee. I ain't had no coffee in 4 months.
Done!
Saying nothing more, Joe turned abruptly and strode off toward the trees. Malcolm and Pete exchanged puzzled glances, then hurried off after him.
We need to fetch our horses. We left them below by that stream.
They're with my horses. Keep up. I expect there'll be a Blackfoot war party coming up here any minute now.
Damn! I told you that damn Frenchman would set the engines on us.
Frenchman didn't tell anybody. He didn't have to. Every Blackfoot this side of the mountains could hear you yelling my name and follow your trail up here.
Moving rapidly, although seemingly without effort, their tall, silent guide led them along a rocky ledge covered with a light dusting of snow. This carried them away from the face of the cliff and into another thick forest of firs. After a few minutes' walk, they came upon a small clearing to discover their horses tied beside 2 belonging to Joe Fox. Without offering any instructions, Joe went directly to a paint pony with an Indian saddle and mounted. Then he grabbed his pack horse's lead and turned the paint's head toward a small game trail that led down the mountain. Still nervous and unsure about their contract with this silent enigma, Malcolm and Pete dutifully followed. It was dusk, with darkness rapidly approaching by the time they reached the narrow river at the base of the mountain.
Make camp here. We'll cook some of that salt pork in your packs tonight. Maybe in the morning I'll find some fresh meat.
Where does this river lead?
It leads to some waterfalls about halfway up the mountain on the other side of this one we're looking at. Your friends thought the same thing you're thinking. They followed it till they had to turn back at the falls. There's a way around the falls, but I reckon they couldn't find it. Wouldn't have done them much good if they had. They'd probably got lost. Those mules would have had to have wings to get over the mountains on the other side of the falls.
So they headed north from here along the base of these mountains?
After they tried a couple more places, both of them box canyons.
Think you can track them?
Maybe, but it ain't likely. It's been 2 months since then. I doubt there'll be any tracks to follow.
Well, then how the hell are you gonna...
All I can do is show you the way to get through the mountains. I can take you to a couple of trails the Kootenai and Flatheads used to get to the buffalo country over on this side. If your friends were lucky, they might have took one of those.
They could have wandered off anywhere in them mountains. We might never find them.
Maybe you change your mind about going with me?
No. We ain't got a chance in hell on our own.
It was settled then, and they went about making their camp by the river. There was a little conversation after their supper, and all 3 were soon in their blankets. Malcolm lay awake for a while. Pete did not. As when fully awake, their new partner was silent in his slumber as well. But Malcolm speculated that he would be alert at the slightest sound. Malcolm thought about the happenings of the day as he lay there staring up at a moonless sky, wondering about the strange man he and Pete had taken on as a guide. Malcolm was not the first person to wonder about Joe Fox. No one really knew where he came from, not even Joe Fox. And there was some uncertainty about his exact age. He was 2 or 3, or maybe 4, when he was found by an old Blackfoot woman named Crying Woman. The boy was sitting beside the body of his mother on the bank of Gray Fox Creek. His dead mother looked to be Piegan, and Crying Woman speculated that She was possibly a casualty of the bloody war between the Piegans and the Grovond. But the boy looked more white than Piegan, causing Crying Woman to further speculate upon the heritage of the father. Childless herself, Crying Woman took the boy home to her village, where she and her husband endeavored to rear him as a Blackfoot warrior. At first, the child would not speak beyond a single word. Whenever he was addressed by either his adoptive mother or father, he would respond with the word Joe. Crying Woman decided that it was his name that he repeated. When it was time to give him a proper name, his new father decided to call the boy Joe Fox because he was found beside Gray Fox Creek. The boy seemed satisfied with his name. A gangly youngster in his early years, he was often the butt of many of the other boys' jokes. His Blackfoot father was not pleased by the development of his son. The Crying Woman never lost faith in Joe's promise. She saw a quiet courage in the youngster that she believed would one day reveal itself. By the time he reached the age of 13 or 14, the gangly youth had disappeared, justifying his mother's faith. A leader among his peers in the village, he was soon allowed to accompany war parties in the Crow Country, an honor for a boy of his age. It was about this time in his life that a Jesuit priest built a mission on the Teton River. Along with some of the other boys who were curious about the white man, Joe visited the mission and became friends with the priest. Realizing Joe had a latent knowledge of English from his early childhood, the priest encouraged him to practice it. Thinking it a game, Joe participated in the lessons until he decided the priest was too focused on saving his soul. The visits to the mission ceased when Joe was around 18 years of age. While he was visiting the priest, a Crow war party seeking revenge for an attack on a Crow hunting party raided the Blackfoot village, killing many, among them Joe's adoptive mother and father. Consumed by grief and guilt, he blamed his parents' death on himself. He'd not been there to protect them. He knew their deaths called for retaliation on his part, so he rode with a war party that caught up to the Crows near the same creek where he'd been found by Crying Woman. A fierce battle ensued with warriors killed on both sides. Joe accounted for two of the Crow dead. After the battle, there was much singing and dancing about the Blackfoot victory. But Joe could not eradicate his feeling of guilt for the loss of his parents. Seeking help, he went to an old medicine man named Hears Thunder. The old man listened while Joe recounted the turmoil with his inner demons of guilt. Then he told him he must go to the mountains, fast for 3 days, and ask Napi to send a vision. Joe's fast lasted 4.5 days before he fell, exhausted and weak, into a deep sleep. Many unrelated things flew haphazardly through his mind, but upon awakening, one vision remained in his memory. A man came to him, a white man. He did not say so, but Joe felt certain it was his father.
"Neither white nor red are you, but a man alone. You must go your own way and follow the voices of the trees and rocks."
The young man was certain then that he was neither Blackfoot nor white. He abandoned thoughts of going in search of his white father, as well as returning to the village of his adoptive parents. Many years had passed since then, but Joe remained in the mountains. In time, he became a legend, talked about by the young men of the tribe when they sat around their campfires, telling of finding sign of the tall warrior on this mountain or that river. But few could boast of actually seeing the lone warrior with their own eyes. In fact, Joe was not totally aware of his image as a phantom until visiting the trading post to trade some hides. The Frenchman who ran the store had been surprised to find that the legend called Joe Fox was in fact a real man. By that time, Joe was resigned to remain in his beloved mountains, accustomed to his solitary existence, content to live without the company of other men, and unconcerned what image his brothers had created for him. And now, upon the arrival of Malcolm and Pete, he found it hard to explain why he had not avoided these two white men. He could have easily. Morning found Malcolm tangled in his blanket and nearly as tired as when he had turned in the night before. He sat up to look around him and noticed at once that Joe Fox was gone. He reached over and gave Pete a kick on the leg.
You awake? Looks like Joe Fox decided not to help us after all.
Pete sat up and, just as Malcolm had, looked to see if the horses were still there.
Well, if that's so, he's left his pack horse.
Damn. I reckon I spoke too soon.
A moment later, a horse came riding into camp from the river. Both men scrambled up out of bed.
I was lucky.
There was a small deer draped across the paint in front of his saddle.
Caught this little doe coming out of the river.
Malcolm was about to remark that he hadn't heard the gunshot when he noticed the arrow still embedded just behind the deer's front leg.
We're going to have to decide what we're going to do. That son of a bitch don't have no idea where the hell we are, and we're going to be sitting here in the middle of these mountains all winter.
Bradley Lindstrom nodded his head solemnly, knowing what Jake Simmons said was probably true. They had been encamped there for 3 days, resting the mules and waiting while their guide purportedly scouted the cuts and valleys, searching for the trail he claimed to be there. That it had probably been covered up by a hard winter was what he had offered as an excuse for the delay. One of many such delays on this ill-fated journey. Bradley felt responsible for their troubles. He had accepted the man's word when Skinner claimed to have traveled through these mountains to Walla Walla before, and the guide had been hired primarily upon Bradley's judgment.
I reckon you're right. We've got to do something to protect our women and children. Can't sit here in this valley all winter.
Maybe we ought to think about trying to build some kind of shelters.
The third member of the discussion was a man named Raymond Chadwick.
Bad weather's going to be here before you know it. There ain't nothing but more of these damn mountains everywhere you look.
Hell, we can't stay here. We'd freeze to death in these mountains if we didn't starve to death first.
During the last few days, when they had been lightly blanketed by an early spring snow, there had been several mentions of a legendary Donner Party. And that had definitely not helped the general morale of the party of settlers.
Jake's right. We can't stay here. One thing I think we're all agreed on, though, we'll be better off without Skinner leading us. I'm the one who hired him. I reckon it's up to me to fire him.
Don't go putting too much blame on yourself. We'll back you up. Won't we, Jake?
Yes, sir. The three of us will tell him we're done with him. Maybe he ever shows up again.
A few minutes before dusk, Skinner finally appeared, emerging from the trees to the south of the camp. He always sat slightly slumped in the saddle, as if constantly tired, wearing a surly expression, except when forcing a belligerent smile.
Maybe we better talk this over with the rest of the train, just to make sure everybody's thinking the same way we are. There's been some talk about turning back while we still got the chance.
They've already said whatever we think is best. We've been going around in circles so long I ain't sure anybody knows the way back to Three Forks, including Skinner. It's time to face up to him. He don't know where we're at any more than we do. We've already thrown away good money on him. Don't make sense to pay him to wander around these mountains hoping to find a way out. I reckon we can do that for ourselves.
Bradley's right. Ain't no use putting it off.
The three settlers climbed slowly to their feet as Skinner drew his horse up before.
Damn if I ain't about to start. I hope you got some coffee left in that pot. What the hell's wrong with you fellas? You look like you smelled a fart.
We've been talking over some things.
Yeah? What kind of thing?
Well, for one thing, we was wondering where you been all day.
Well, what the hell do you think I've been doing? Wearing my horse out, scouting for that trail out of this valley. That's what I've been doing, by God. Trying to lead you and your families to Oregon.
Did you find the trail you've been talking about?
I found a couple of trails that might be it. Ain't no fault of mine if the trails were covered by bad winter. But I know the way to go. Tomorrow morning, we'll pack up and follow the river.
I don't see how that's gonna do much good for us. Looks pretty much like this river runs north and south. I never claimed to be much of a guide, but I don't see how following this river north is ever gonna get us west, which is what we paid you to do.
Just what are you getting at, Lindstrom?
Well, there ain't no polite way of saying it, so I'll just out with it. We decided it best to try to find our way out of here ourselves. We don't think you know where we are or how to get us where we want to go. We paid you half the money before we started out. We don't figure you earned it, but we're willing to forget it in part, no hard feelings. We think that's more than fair for both sides.
Well, ain't that just a fine howdy-do? You just decided to fire me, did you? And while I'm out risking my neck to keep you from getting slaughtered by Indians. Oh, we'll just part company and no hard feelings. Well, that ain't the way it's gonna work. We shook hands on it. $250 when we left Bismarck and $250 when we get to the Willamette Valley. And the deal's a deal. Now, after I took you more than halfway, risking my neck, you want to back out of the deal? Well, you can go ahead and back out if that's what you want to do. But I'll have the rest of the money you owe me. And then, only then, we'll part company with no hard feelings.
Well, listen, Skinner, all you did was get us good and lost. We don't owe you nothing. Thanks to you, we're likely to get caught here by winter storms. You ought to give us back the money we already gave you.
You and your belly-aching bunch of pilgrims can go to hell for all I care. The whole lot of you.
Skinner dropped his hand to rest on the handle of his pistol, daring any one of them to protest.
There ain't no call to get testy about this. We just want to part ways in peace and no hard feelings.
You can kiss my ass. So be it. You damn fools will perish without me, and it serves you right. This won't be the last you'll see of me.
Cora Simmons came out of her tent, joining the three men by the fire.
Now where's he going?
Who knows and who cares? We just fired him.
So now we don't have a guide.
Hell, we didn't have one before.
Question is, what do we do now?
I don't see that we've got much choice. We can't stay here, so I say we follow the river north in the morning. Maybe we'll find a pass that'll take us through the mountains.
Joe Fox knelt at the crossing of two game trails and examined the droppings that he was now sure were left by the long mule train.
They're lost all right.
Malcolm and Pete filed in behind him. Those four words were the first he had spoken since earlier in the morning, when he had discovered a distinct track that told him the party had veered off toward a narrow mountain pass to the west. Joe abruptly raised his hand. He examined the ground.
Trouble, maybe.
What kind of trouble?
See here?
Joe pointed to some disturbed pine needles on the high side of the trail.
Riders. Maybe Blackfoot, maybe Flathead, maybe Grovant, but Indian. Unshod ponies. Whoever it was must have come up from there.
He pointed toward a rocky ledge above the trail.
They struck this trail, and now they're following the same tracks we are.
Damn! Can you tell how many there were?
Hard to say. I'd guess it's six or eight, but that's only a guess.
How long ago?
2 days, maybe three.
There was no need for discussion. The only thing for them was to make the best time possible and hope to catch up in time to help their friends. Seth Skinner pressed his horse relentlessly as he backtracked down the mountainside, the same one he had led the settlers up days before. Still angry over his abrupt dismissal, he considered the situation he now found himself in. He had money in his pocket, but he could not stop thinking about the equal sum he would have received had he been able to finish the journey. The fact that everything he had told Bradley Lindstrom about his knowledge of the Rocky Mountains was an outright lie did not trouble his conscience. Men like Bradley Lindstrom were fair game for double dealers like Skinner. Taking advantage of his master's inattention, the big Morgan that Skinner rode gradually slowed its pace until finding one more to its liking. So absorbed in his thoughts of scheming to somehow get his hands on the rest of the money that Lindstrom had promised, he wasn't aware that the horse slowed to a leisurely walk until he glanced up to see the Indian warrior sitting his pony in the middle of the trail, watching him.
Me.
Friend.
No white man is my friend.
No. I'm a friend, sure enough. I can lead you to a bunch of white men that are your enemies, though. And we can share their supplies and guns.
The broad-shouldered warrior pulled his pony up beside him and yanked his rifle from the scabbard. He raised it above his head, and Skinner watched as more Indian warriors rode out of the woods, surrounding him.
Chiknut-tichlan!
Hell, I'll just take the money and you boys can have everything else. I've always been a friend of the Blackfoot.
We are A'aninen. The Blackfoot are our enemies. If you are their friends, then you are our enemy.
No, I didn't mean I was their friends. Look, I can lead you to a rich train of whites and you can have it all.
We don't need you to lead us. A blind dog can follow this trail.
Watching the youngest member of his war party claim his first kill, Dead Man nodded his silent approval. While others searched the white man's saddlebags, Two Arrows nudged his pony up beside Dead Man's. He held the rifle out for Dead Man to admire.
Shoot many times.
Dead Man smiled and nodded. It was a rare trophy.
Maybe the tracks will lead us to more of these guns.
Again, Dead Man nodded. The acquisition of such fine weapons would be a good thing, but equally important would be the opportunity to punish the white men for trespassing in his country. Dead Man hated the white man even more than the treacherous Blackfoot.
You know him?
Lord of mercy.
Pete saw the body lying beside the trail. Instinctively, both he and Malcolm grasped their rifles and began looking around them expectantly.
The ones who did this are long gone. Is this one of your friends?
Hard to say for sure. I mean, with his face all hanging loose like that. But it don't look like anybody I've ever seen.
We didn't know any of the folks my brother and his family joined. He might have been with them. Was it Blackfoot?
Maybe. Can't say who did it. They didn't leave no sign. I wonder what he was doing up here by himself. Looks like those folks you're trying to find might be in for some trouble. This bunch that did this are most likely on a killing spree, and they're on your folks' trail. We'd best get along.
Damn! Trouble! We gotta help them!
We're going. These horses can't make much better time on these steep trails, so it'll be close to sundown by the time we get around to the other side of this mountain.
As Joe had predicted, the sun was dropping close to the western peaks by the time they reached the low ridge that overlooked the valley floor and the river that ran through the center.
Wait here. I'll see what we got to deal with, then I'll get back to you.
Joe made his way down the ridge 50 yards or so to an outcropping of rock that offered plenty of protection. while allowing a wide view of the river below. Crouched behind the rocks, Joe discovered several spent rifle cartridges, and he knew that the attack started there. Several cook fires still smoking told him that the settlers must have been camped beside the river when the Indians struck, forcing them to withdraw to take cover under the riverbank. Consequently, the warriors had advanced to a stand of trees some 50 yards from the banks of the river. Joe scanned the trees until he located the Indian ponies tied near a thicket of berry bushes. He counted 8 Indian ponies, plus another saddled horse, which he assumed to have belonged to the white man they had found dead on the trail. Then he watched for rifle fire, trying to spot the 8 warriors. When he was certain of at least half of them, he backed away from the rocks and returned for Malcolm and Pete.
Leave the horses here. Best I can tell, we've got 8 to deal with. Can you hit what you aim at?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, follow me and don't shoot till I tell you to. Maybe we'll save your friends, or whatever's left of them.
Joe turned and led him down to the rocks and positioned him to his satisfaction. Pointing to the partially hidden raiders in the trees below, he instructed them to pick a target.
I want to hit them hard the first time, so don't miss. Shoot when I give you the signal. Be ready to fire again, because most likely you'll see where the others are when they shoot back at us. If we hit them hard enough, they might hightail it.
Both men eagerly nodded their understanding. Joe acknowledged this with a nod of his own. When Joe gave the signal to fire, it produced the results he had anticipated. Their aim was true, and 3 warriors fell. As he'd predicted, the other 5 were confused at first, then reversed their positions to fire back at the sudden attack. In doing so, 2 of the warriors revealed their hiding places. Joe was quick. Joe bounded over the face of the rocks and made straight for the raiders' horses. He charged into their midst and scattered the frightened mounts up the hillside.
Hiya! Hiya!
A warrior suddenly materialized out of the woods. Joe raised his handgun. Effectively defeated, the 2 remaining raiders fled up the hillside after their horses. Crouching beneath the riverbank, the besieged party of settlers was left to gape at one another in a state of confusion over the assault from the ridge and the sudden flight of their attackers. Bradley Lindstrom eased his head up to eye level, still wary that he might attract a bullet or an arrow.
Brad!
Malcolm!
Bradley could scarcely believe his eyes as his brother and another man emerged from the trees in the fading light. Realizing that the danger was over, the rest of their people began to make their way back up from the river to the campsite. Bradley ran forth to greet his brother with a hearty hug.
I didn't know I'd ever be this glad to see you. Howdy, Pete. You're sure a sight for sore eyes, just the 2 of you.
Before Malcolm could answer, he saw Nancy running to greet him, so he turned to receive her welcome embrace as well.
Thank the Lord you showed up when you did. Are they gone?
They're gone.
Simmons hurried up to join the reunion.
You 2 did a powerful good job of shooting.
Us and Joe Fox. Most of it Joe Fox.
Bradley looked around at that, searching for another person.
He took off after them 2 that got away, to make sure they had run for sure, I reckon.
It's good to see you again, and that's for certain. We were in a pretty bad fix, and it looked like we were going to be pinned down on this river till after dark. Who's Joe Fox?
It's hard to say. He's about as close to a wild Indian as you can get, I reckon. But if it wasn't for him, we'd have never found you.
Bradley was about to press for more details, but he was interrupted by the rest of the folks in the mule train as they gathered around their 2 rescuers. He introduced his brother and Pete to everybody and stood back while the 2 were made welcome. Unnoticed by the jubilant congregation, Joe emerged from the dark shadows of the firs, driving 3 Indian ponies. After hobbling the horses, he strode over to the body of dead man, made a brief examination, then went on to kneel by the body of two arrows.
Hey, Joe, come on over here. Here's a man you want to give thanks to. This is Joe Fox, and he's going to lead you out of these mountains.
Well, hallelujah.
I saw you kneeling beside those bodies, and I know you were raised by the Blackfeet. I know it must be eating at your heart to have killed some of your own people, but you done the right thing.
Atsina, they weren't Blackfoot, they were Grovant.
Oh, then it wasn't such a bad thing for you that we killed them?
It was a damn good thing that we killed them. What I'm trying to figure out is why they're so far away from their reservation at Fort Belknap. If I had to guess, I'd suspect they're part of a bigger raiding party. I'm sorry two of them got away. The old ones told stories about a time when the Blackfeet and the Atsina were friends, and then a war broke out between them over a white horse and two dead Grovant. The Atsina blamed the Blackfeet after seeing the horse in our village. They didn't know that a party of snakes had given the horse to the Blackfeet. They were the ones who killed the two Atsina warriors. But there's been bad blood between my people and the Atsina ever since.
Fam, that's most words I've ever heard you string together at one time.
Suddenly embarrassed, Joe shrugged and turned to tend to his horses.
You said he was going to lead us out of these infernal mountains? Well, yeah, that's what we came here for. That's right, ain't it, Joe?
Can you lead us out of here, Mr. Fox?
You know the way through these mountains.
The question came from a brute of a man who had been content to listen up to that point. He stepped through the gathering.
We just run one sorry scalawag off that claimed he could lead us to the Willamette Valley. Well, now you show up, claiming to know the way out of this canyon. How do we know you even have a notion where the Willamette Valley is?
I can take you out.
Huh.
I can take you out of here to a better place to camp. I ain't sure you can make it past all the mountains between here and where you're talking about going before the snow closes most of the mountain passes. And I don't know the Willamette Valley you spoke of, but I know how to find Oregon.
What the hell do you mean? We can't spend the winter in these mountains. I don't know about the rest of you folks, but I need to get to Oregon before winter sets in. And I don't care what no half-Injun says. I say we quit pussyfooting around and strike out straight across these damn mountains.
Hold on, Starbo. There ain't no call to get your back up till we talk this over.
That's just the damn trouble we had all along. You and Simmons and Chadwick ain't been good for nothing but talking things over between yourselves. Well, I held my tongue up until now, but I have my say on this. You hired that damn no-account Skinner, and now you're hiring this half-breed to just drop down out of a tree somewhere. I want to know why the hell we can't be past the mountains before winter sets in.
Let's try to keep a civil tongue here, Starbo.
Bradley looked at Joe Fox.
Is what you say our only choice? Why can't we make it through before winter?
You started too late in the summer. You've been going around in circles and you got too far left to go. I said I could lead you out of the mountains. I never said it would be easy, and I never promised you'd make it before spring. A man can't say for sure what the winter will be. Maybe the snow will come late and the passes will stay open, but I doubt it. I've seen no sign. I can take you to Missoula Mills, where you'll find some more white people. If you're wise, you'll set up your winter camp there.
What will we do? We'll perish in these mountains.
You'll perish if you try to strike out straight west like this damn fool wants to. I'll lead you north from here until we get to a valley I know. It's a little longer than the way a hawk flies. But these mules don't look much like hawks to me. And the way I'll take you, there's game for food if you have to settle in for the winter.
If we make it to that valley you mentioned, will we be free of the mountains?
Joe made a concentrated effort to hide his astonishment for the naivete of Raymond's question.
No, you'll still be in the Bitterroots. There will be many days' journey beyond that.
Oh, no. This is just like the Donner Party.
Don't even start that kind of talk. We ain't the Donner Party. We're able-bodied men, and we can build a warm winter camp if we have to. Joe Fox here says he can keep us supplied with food. You just gotta have faith in the Lord and faith in ourselves.
Get faith in Joe Fox.
Ain't nobody said you had to stay with the party, Starbo. You wouldn't be here in the first place, but you asked to tag along after we left Bismarck.
Jake's wife, Cora, took him by the arm and pulled him a few steps away.
Let it lay, Jake.
Yeah, little man. You best listen to your wife and let it lay, else you're liable to get your scrawny little back broke.
20 miles out from Bismarck, Starbo had suddenly appeared, riding a broad-chested dun and leading 4 mules with heavy packs. He said he was a pilgrim, just like the rest of the party, looking for a place to settle where he could practice his Christian beliefs. Bradley should have listened to Jake then when his wiry little friend doubted the rough man's sincerity. It had not taken long before the rest of the party had doubts about the loner in their midst. With few words for any of the others, Starbo had kept to himself for the entire journey, never asking nor offering assistance on any matter, and preferring never to participate in the nightly prayers. It was soon apparent that the surly brute was along strictly for the safety of numbers. Now he had permitted his venomous core to emerge, and again Bradley felt it his responsibility to defuse the volatile incident.
Cora's right, Jake. It's best to calm down. We're all just a little bit touchy right now.
Can't no man talk to me that way. I'll have your apology now, by God.
Or what? What are you going to do about you, little bantam rooster? I do what I please, and I say what I damn well please. What are any of you Bible-thumping sons of bitches going to do about it? Huh? Yeah, I thought so. All right, you yellow belly. You got a gun on your belt. You ready to back up that big mouth of yours?
We need to calm down.
Jake tried to push Cora out of his way, determined to defend his pride.
No, Jake, no!
But maybe you ought to give her the gun, Simmons. Well, she looks like she's got more spunk than you. Maybe you ought to come on over to my camp, Cora. I believe I could give you a little more of what a woman like you needs. I bet you ain't getting it from that bantam.
Making his way through the ring of horrified spectators, Joe stepped in front of Jake. Turning to face Starbo, he raised his rifle and took dead aim on the bully's forehead.
Oh, what the hell? This ain't none of your affair.
It ain't a fair fight.
It ain't a fair fight. Ain't none of your business, you damn half-breed.
Now it is.
All right, mister. You want a showdown, you can have it. You're wearing a pistol. Put down that rifle, we'll see who walks away from here.
Why would I do that?
For a fair fight, damn it! Ain't a fair fight with you already holding a rifle on me!
I don't fight fair.
Starbo abruptly turned and started toward his tent. Joe lowered his rifle slowly, watching the sullen brute depart until Malcolm appeared at his elbow.
That was too close for comfort.
With reflexes sharpened by a life of survival in the wild, Joe whipped his rifle up and aimed at Starbo, who had just fired.
Ow! No!
His shot took Starbo in the shoulder. Joe went straight to the wounded man, his rifle aimed at his head.
Wait! There's been enough killing with us starting to kill each other. He's wounded and you were right to shoot to defend yourself, but if you shoot him now, it'll be nothing less than murder.
The man tried to kill me. I don't give a man more than one chance if I can help it.
The Bible says thou shalt not kill. We are Christians, so I'm asking you not to pull that trigger. At least let us call a council to talk this thing over.
What does your Bible say about those Grovant we killed?
They were heathen, savages, no different than protecting ourselves from a pack of wolves.
Jake Simmons and Raymond Chadwick walked up to join him.
Bradley's right. I reckon I'm the one most to blame. I forgot my Christian duty when I got my back up over Starbo's remarks. I think he's been punished enough. He's hurt pretty bad, looks like. I think it's best to just let him go his own way if he doesn't share our beliefs, and let the rest of us go ours.
He's right. The whole reason we're bound for Oregon is to be free to practice our religion as we see fit, doing harm to no one.
He'll try again.
Maybe not, if we show him mercy and forgiveness. But we must be sure this whole incident is finished.
What do you say, Starbo? Is it over?
Yeah. It's over and done. I just took a leave of my senses for a spell there. I got no hard feelings for Simmons or anybody else. And I appreciate it if you would let me stay with the party.
Good. I think you've made a wise decision. If you give him a chance, the Lord will show you the way. Now, let's get you over to your tent and see if we can patch that wound up.
I reckon if that's what you folks want. But a coyote's still a coyote whether he's been shot or not. And I'll always keep my eye on wounded coyotes. I expect we'd best get moving first thing in the morning.
Never comfortable in a crowd, Joe built his fire near his horses and apart from the main camp. He thought about the strange turn of events that had resulted in the settlers forgiving a man after he had attempted to kill someone, and he was afraid that he might live to regret his bowing to their wishes. Malcolm and Pete stopped by to talk before joining Bradley's family for supper.
I didn't know nothing about this religious business any sooner than you did. Not that there's anything wrong with having religion. Hell, I got a little bit myself. I can see how you feel about letting Starbo go after the son of a bitch took a shot at you. I reckon we'd all best keep a close eye on that one, won't we, Pete?
Pete nodded.
These folks are good folks, and they need you. I'm just hoping you ain't thinking about washing your hands of the whole thing.
I said I'd lead you through these mountains.
Yes, sir, you did. And you're a man of your word. I'm obliged.
Malcolm and Pete weren't the only visitors to Joe's camp that evening. He had just pulled his coffee back from the center of the fire to keep it from boiling too long when he saw someone leave the circle of campfires and head toward him. He watched as the figure became clear in the darkness of the tree line. It was a girl, or a woman. It was hard to tell because the figure was a small person, possibly a child. He straightened up and waited, curious as to the purpose of the visit.
Mr. Fox?
Yes, miss.
As she entered the firelight, he could see that she was indeed a young woman, though tiny in stature. He saw then that she carried something wrapped in a cloth.
I brought you some pan bread that I made for supper.
Why, I'm much obliged to you, miss. It'll go mighty good with my coffee.
I'm Callie Simmons. I wanted to thank you for saving my father's life. I'm Jake Simmons' daughter, and I'm certain that when you stepped in between him and that ogre Starbo, you saved his life. Pa's a good man, but he's not a big man, so I think he sometimes feels like he has to show people that he's as much a man as anyone. Anyway, I thank you for what you did, and I hope you enjoy the bread. I'll leave you to your supper. The folks on this train aren't as stiff as they might look. You'll see when you get to know us better.
The days that followed the incident by the river became a constant grind of long hours in the saddle that left the travelers weary and hungry when nightfall finally forced them to camp. There were no complaints from the people because Bradley and Jake had impressed upon the others the need to pass through the mountains as quickly as humanly possible. The days were already cold and the skies continued to threaten, with heavy snows already blanketing the higher elevations. Not much was seen of their mysterious guide during the daylight hours. He would start the party out in the mornings, telling Malcolm and Bradley to hold a particular course. Then he would disappear into the forest and hills, only to appear when it seemed the train had reached a box canyon or some other apparent dead end. He would then lead them on a detour that sometimes called for him to follow a game trail barely wide enough for one mule to pass, and becoming more and more treacherous with freeze and rain. It was not an easy time for man or woman, but everyone, even the children, seemed to understand the desperate circumstances that dictated the demands put upon them. As before, Starbo kept to himself, riding sullenly, his arm in a sling fashioned by Nancy Lindstrom to rest his wounded shoulder. He, as much as anyone, wanted to get through the mountains before the passes closed. And although he harbored a deep hatred for the man who had led him through one rough valley after another, he was wise enough to know his survival depended upon Joe Fox. In spite of the rugged terrain, the mule train made acceptable progress for the first few days, even with the foul weather. On the fifth day of travel, Old Man Winter evidently reached the limits of his benevolence when Joe led a saddle-weary group of settlers across a frigid mountain pass where howling winds were already sweeping the snow into six-foot drifts. It served to impress upon the travelers what they would have encountered had they insisted upon continuing their trek to Oregon Territory. Once through the pass, Joe led them down into a wide valley, where the surrounding mountains offered some relief from the weather above, and a cluster of crude buildings created a welcome sight that Joe said was Missoula Mills.
It's a good place for your people to spend the winter months. There's a sawmill and a flour mill and a general store. The Missoula Valley has three rivers running through it, and the mountains all around will protect against the strong winter storms.
Bradley stood beside Jake Simmons as the two friends got their first look at the valley.
Well, it ain't the Willamette Valley where we thought we'd be spending the winter, but it looks a sight more inviting than those deep canyons back yonder. What about when the spring comes? We're still going to be looking for the way to Oregon.
The road you spoke about is...
The Mullen Road?
Yes, the Mullen Road. It runs through the Missoula Valley. You can follow it in the spring when the passes are open.
Maybe you'll go with us then.
Maybe. But I'll help you store up meat for the winter anyway. You're going to need a lot for this bunch of folks.
We're obliged. We best get to work building some shelters.
The next 2 weeks were a busy time for the pilgrims as they hurried to establish a winter camp. They were welcomed by the people of the settlement, who turned out to help the new arrivals, hoping they would elect to make permanent homes there. Joe spent all day every day scouting the breadth and length of the fertile valley in search of the game to be dried and stored. Game was in abundance. Mule deer, white-tailed deer, and elk driven down from the mountains by the weather. Bradley was happy to supply him with all the cartridges he needed, but much of the game was shot with a bow.